Good morning and welcome to the Peace and Justice Report. I'm Tom Walker. John Dickman is in the studio today. We're here live every Wednesday morning from 9 until 10. And our co-host, Bob Connors, is headed for the doctors this morning, but he'll be back next week. Please note that the opinions you hear on this show are our own, those of our guests, and do not necessarily represent those of the board or its employees or its volunteers. Our first guest this morning is Nate Jacobs. Nate is the founder and artistic director of West Coast Black Theater Troupe. Its mission since 1999 has been to produce professional theater that promotes and celebrates African-American history and experience, engages a broad base of patrons and audiences, supports the development of a dynamic group of aspiring artists, and builds self-esteem in youth of color. He's a graduate of Florida A&M, and he's written, composed, directed, and performed in many shows as an actor, singer, dancer, and comedian. He trains and mentors youth in the performing arts through programs such as Stage of Discovery, their summer musical theater intensive program. The Sarasota County branch of the NAACP Youth Council recognized Nate as one of its 2012 Men of Valor. And in 2021, he received the Perfect Pitch Award from Key Corral, which recognized him as a driving force in the arts and for his collaboration with other art organizations. So welcome, Nate.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
The reason you're here, you've written a new musical. Its title is Ruby, and it premieres March 1st with previews on February 28th and 29th. Please tell us all about it.
Ruby is a collaboration of me and one of my brothers, Michael Jacobs. Several years ago, one of the patrons sent an email to me, and the email contained information about the story of Ruby McClone, which is a true life story that happened in Live Oak, Florida in 1952. When her husband moves to Live Oak, and everybody is wondering, the Black community and white community, where in the world did they get the kind of money that they have to live the kind of lifestyle that they live? And they began to do business with a very prominent white man, one of the most prominent there, who is a doctor. He is running for Senate. And the only doctor that sees Black patients. And one Sunday morning, August 3rd, Ruby wakes up and goes to his office, doctor's office, and shoot him dead. Hmm. And then, you know, kind of all hell breaks loose. Everybody wants to know what is going on. Why did this woman shoot this man? And then we begin to delve deeper into what is going on and find out that she has a child from this white man, a daughter. And delving even deeper, find out all of the vice and drama and intrigue and mystery of what was going on. And so I decided to tell this story in a musical. So it's all original music. And tell our version of the Ruby McClone story. There was one movie done on this story some years back called You Belong to Me. And a lot of video material on YouTube about the story. A Black newspaper, Pittsburgh Courier, sent the prominent writer Zora Neale Hurston to Live Oak to cover the trial because she wanted to be able to talk to Ruby to find out the big why, and found out that she was under a gag order from the judge. No one could talk with her. The mystery was how in the world this black woman shoots in daylight a white gentleman, and she's not lynched. She lives to tell the story. And we try to tell some of that, you know, give some of that answer of why she was left alive and spared, not just her, her husband and the whole family wasn't wiped off the face of the earth after that.
That is crazy.
So we're very excited about this musical.
Wow. So you,
we're excited. It talks about also, yes, I'm listening.
Go ahead.
Zora Neale Hurston called this thing the Paramore Rights, and she talked about, you know, for centuries, how slave women were just taken from their homes, from their husbands, and the white owners, plantation owners, would just do what they wanted with these women. And a lot of that finds its way in the Ruby McClone story. This man starting off to be her doctor and then becoming her abuser, which has a lot to do with the conflict in that relationship that ended up in murder. So it's very intriguing and spellbinding, kind of murder mystery, to be honest with you. But the music is phenomenal, and everybody is just anticipating to see this show because this is the third time we have attempted to put it on stage. Pandemic took it off the stage twice over the last few years. And so we are extremely excited to actually do the story.
When did you start working on it? A long time ago?
Three years ago. I saw the information, and then I sent the email to my brother, who was in Washington, Baltimore area. And he has now since semi-retired and actually moved to Sarasota, bought him a home, him and his family. And we decided, I said, how do you read this and tell me what you think? He was like, oh my God, this is phenomenal. Yeah. So we decided about 3 years ago that we would get together and develop this new musical called Ruby.
You give him credit for the lyrics, I think, in your announcement. Is that true? He wrote the lyrics?
He wrote the book of the musical, and he wrote the lyrics, and I took his lyrics and kind of had to do some editing to form them into what would be a song. And I came up with the orchestration, the not necessarily the orchestration, but the arrangements of each song. And then some wonderful guys, Nehemiah Luckett, Wimberly, Antonio Wimberly, Brennan Styles, and now more recent, Dan Wells, are gentlemen that I work with to do orchestrations for the arrangements that I put together.
Now, this is not the first musical you've written, right? You've written lots of them. Is that true?
Very true. There is one that we are bringing back by popular demand this season, which is Marvin Gaye, Prince of Soul.
Right.
And it is, of course, a musical that talks about the man, Marvin Gaye, and, of course, his industry changing music from Motown and beyond. And that is one of our most popular shows at WBTT. And I wrote that in 2011, inspired from a young man right out of Sarasota community who I was working with at the theater, and realized one day how much he embodied the character, personality, and voice of the iconic singer Marvin Gaye, and his name is Sheldon Rodin, a native of Sarasota. And so I developed the musical around him, and he stepped on the stage, and it has not been the same since. So this is the fourth time I'm bringing back this musical, and it's almost sold out again.
I saw on, I think it was Sunday, I saw the Soldier Story. Amazing production with so many cast members. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. So proud of that show. We got a remarkable cast.
And people should go. Is it still a playing, or is it too late?
It plays through the 18th of February. The 18th of February closes.
Oh, wow. So there's still time to see it. A soldier's play. It's about a military, a black military outfit. The army was segregated back then, but there's a murder. Uh-huh. And there's a murder, and the question is, who did it? And there's a lot of powerful characters in it. I thought it was excellent.
Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it. We've getting nothing but rave reviews, as we should, because Chuck Smith, who is one of my artistic associates, who works with WBTT and the Goodman Theater in Chicago, which is where he's from. But he bought a home here, and I'm so glad that he is a part of our artistic team at WBTT. It has done a phenomenal job. And these 12 men who are on that stage just come night after night and just take us to that place of that story, that world, and tell that story so well. So it deals a lot with what hatred and what prejudices do to people. And so it's a powerful, powerful story. And yes, if you have not seen a soldier's play written by Charles Fuller, it was a play that was developed at the Negro Ensemble Company, which is the first professional black theater that started in Harlem in the 1970s, starring Denzel Washington and Samuel Jackson. And mostly every black lead film star has cut their teeth on a soldier's play.
Right. And you have some amazing actors in your production. They're really great. Well, getting back to the story of Ruby, Ruby McCollum, does the musical follow her all the way through
in the music, we start actually at the murder, almost like a soldier's play, and then we flash back. So the audience get to know who this woman was, other than labeled murderer. So we go back and we learn about who Ruby is and who her husband is and how they got to the prominence that they got to, which was a lot of hard work because they had decided they were going to live life a certain way and they were going to achieve the American dream. And then we come back to present day and go through the trial, which she is put before all male, all white jewelry,
right,
in down south Florida, which was okay. There was no chance she was going to be actually treated fair.
I believe she was forced to bear a child from the doctor, right?
She did, and she actually got pregnant two more times.
Wow.
He paid for her to get rid of the second baby. Mm. And then the third one, she lost. Yes, very, very true. It was a very abusive relationship, both toward her and the husband, because, of course, this man felt like he could do whatever he could. And of course, he had the support from the community, a very powerful man. And they had worked hard to get to where they were, and it was a problem for him. And he felt like if he could not be a part of what made them who they were, then they were not going to be able to succeed the way they had dreamed. And that lied the problem with them even aligning with him, because he wanted to take over their empire.
Oh, yeah. It was some of it's based on illegal gambling, a sort of gambling her husband was running.
Yes, that was one of the ways that he accrued his wealth was Bolito. He was known as the Bolito King mm-hmm. back there, the numbers game.
Right, right.
And poker. He was good at poker.
All right. So she was convicted and sentenced to death, right? But that's not the end of the story. Do you go further to her second trial?
She was sentenced to death, and then a lawyer came in, and to keep her alive, got another trial to decide whether or not she was totally sane,
right,
when she killed him.
Right.
Because that is pretty abnormal for a woman to get up on Sunday and go shoot someone dead, get back in her. She has her children waits for her in the car.
Right.
She gets back in the car, drives back home, go in the kitchen, begin to cook for her family. Mm-hmm. And when the police came to pick her up, she was in the kitchen cooking. And so they had another trial to see, was she really mentally sane? And she was found, sane. But at the end of the matter, she was not sent to jail. She was sent to Chattahoochee, right, which is the popular mental institution. That's over near Live Oak, Florida. Even today, the building still stands.
And she eventually got out on the Baker Act?
She did. She got out of that, and she lived life until she passed away.
So was she allowed, by the way, there's some question about whether blacks were allowed to serve on the jury. I thought I read that there were two alternate black people, but in general, blacks were not on the juries. It was an all white jury, right? And was she allowed to testify at all, or was some of that squelched?
They did allow her to testify somewhat. They kept stopping her. Anytime she got to saying anything about us, objection, sustained, objection. And so she really never told her story, her side of the story. It was very well, strategically planned how much she would say.
Yeah, that, of course, we wouldn't say that was fair. Yeah.
No, not at all. So the story really never came out. That's why even today in Live Oak, it is taboo and residents don't even like talking about it. I know people from Live Oak and they, we don't talk about that kind of thing.
Why? What are they? What's the matter? They're not ashamed of her. She stood up and fought back. I mean, I don't understand.
One woman I spoke with she said she was a child when Ruby and Sam McClone was there. And she said, we were just fascinated by them. She said, I remember as a child walking by their two-story mansion, just wondering how in the world did somebody who looked like me could live like that. She said, they were our heroes. And when they fell from grace, we were really hurt and disappointed because our heroes fell from grace, the black community. We had never seen them before, and they gave us hope to dream. And so we were very hurt and disappointed when
I got
their demise happened. Yeah.
Talk.
So I don't know why they don't want to talk about it. Maybe they just know it was just done so very wrong and they were treated so very fair. The day she murdered the doctor, she lost her husband. He had a heart attack and he died on the same day. Just a total, almost Greek tragedy with this couple.
Talk about Zora Neale Hurston, who came to town with the Pittsfield Courier to cover the trial, the first trial. I've read six of her short stories. She's a great writer. She was also an anthropologist. Talk a little bit about Zora and the part she plays in the musical.
Zora is our narrator.
Oh.
And she narrates the story as she is trying to report on the story, because the newspaper censor there. Yeah. So we get to know more about how the story played out through the character of Zora Neale Hurston, who was known for getting down nitty and gritty with the people. Yeah. And keeping the language slang and the rhythms of a community and of a people. That's what she was known for, mainly documenting what really happens in the Black communities. So she plays a major part in our production of Ruby. We were so very fortunate because my brother, when he began research and began writing the book for the musical, he found out that one of our cousins has a business where he bought all of the archival material from Black newspapers across the nation. And so he finds this out. He calls the cousin and he says, would you happen to have purchased the Pittsburgh Courier archives? He said, yes, I have them. And he told him about, we were developing this musical. So we got the actual writings of Zora Neale Hurston that she wrote for that Black newspaper. And that's where we built, that was the foundation that we built our show off of.
Wow, that's couldn't be more accurate.
I know, isn't it?
Couldn't be more accurate. She was there, right?
Couldn't be more accurate. We got her literal words and phrasing of how what she saw down there and how she interpreted that, being a Black woman herself and had gone through a lot of that scrutiny in her own career, how she could definitely relate to the trauma of Ruby.
Okay, so Ruby premieres March 1st, and there's a couple of days of trials, previews. And the Soldiers Play is playing right now, and you got the Marvin Gaye coming.
The 18th, and then after Ruby, we present Marvin Gaye, Prince of Soul.
We got a couple more minutes. You want to talk about the Discovery Camp or anything else?
The Discovery is our youth. Musical theater intensive. My background began as a school teacher at a private school here, West Coast School for Human Development. I'm not a native of Sarasota. I am a native of Tampa, Daytona Beach. I went to Florida A&M University in Tallahassee. Took some courses at Florida State University. And I moved here because the founders of the private school asked me to come and help them with their school. And I had come to Sarasota, I'm thinking that I would volunteer pretty much some time to them for 5 or 6 months, and I've taught at the school for 12 years because I really fell in love with what I was doing and working with the students there. And so my background is I developed a drama program within the school, and I really think that was the incubator of when I really wrapped my hands around eventually founding West Coast Black Theater Troupe, which is 25 years old this year. Wow. I can hardly believe it. And so my work began with young people. The foundation of our theater company was born from me working with teenage aspiring actors and artists. And so I made sure that we continued that by forming Stage of Discovery, which is a 5-week musical theater intensive. We have about 35 kids on our campus, Monday through Friday, 10 o'clock to 3 o'clock. The last 2 weeks before they do their big showcase, we keep them till 5 o'clock, those 2 weeks. And these showcases are becoming as popular as Marvin Gaye, Prince of Soul. because these kids are really doing a phenomenal job through this musical intensive workshop. We have professionals that train them. We have music professionals, choreographer professionals, and acting professionals working with teenagers 13 to 18. And they have a 5-week camp and do a showcase for about 3 performances. And so I'm very excited about that. It's always a big success every summer, full camp, and the parents are just really thrilled at their kids getting that kind of experience, and so am I.
How many productions? They do, what, 3 shows at the end of their summer camp?
They typically do 2 to 3 performances, and they pack them out. They're packed out before the dates even roll around with their family, their aunts and grandparents and siblings. And it's also a good way for us to do outreach to especially the Black community through that program, because many times they have family members who have never stepped foot in anybody's theater, and they come to those performances. So that's another thing I really love about it.
Great, great. We've been talking to Nate Jacobs, and his new musical, Ruby, opens March 1st. And the 2 days of previews at the West Coast Black Theater Troupe. Thank you, Nate, for being here. Thank you for everything you do. And congratulations on your new auditorium, which, of course, is amazing compared to the old one.
Love it, love it, love it. Yes.
So you've been embraced by the community, I would say, and supported, and it's congratulations on everything you've done for Sarasota. We'll see you at the theater.
Yes.
And thank you again for all you do. I'm sure Ruby will be well received in Sarasota.
Thank you. I appreciate the time and your appreciation for us.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
See you later. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Uh-huh. As I said, we've been talking to Nate Jacobs. His new musical, Ruby, opens March 1st. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota. Listen on the web at WSLR.org or through our free application. Is go to your app store and download it. You click on it and it starts playing immediately. Of course, you can always go to our website and click listen now, which is another way to hear it. You don't have to be in FM radio range to hear our show. We're also a podcast on all the podcast platforms. Just look for Peace and Justice Report. As I said, Bob Connors is in the doctor's office right now. He'll be back next week. And I want to let me introduce our second guest. Our second guest today is the Reverend Paul Brandeis. The Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. Since last September, he's been president and CEO of the Interfaith Alliance. He's an ordained Baptist minister, a longtime leader in the interfaith movement, working to protect an inclusive vision of religious freedom for people of all faiths and none. As the great-grandson of the first Jewish Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis and the great-grandson of Baptist theologian Walter Rauschenbusch, a key figure in the social gospel movement, his commitment to interfaith advocacy comes in part from his own interfaith background. Prior to coming to Interfaith Alliance, he served as senior vice president of the Auburn Seminary, as the founding and executive director of HuffPost Religion, as associate dean of religious life and the chapel at Princeton University, and as founding editor of BeliefNet.com. Most recently, he was the senior advisor for public affairs and innovation at Interfaith America. In addition to his work as president, he also serves as host for State of Belief Radio, their weekly radio show and podcast. Now, this interview, he couldn't be here this morning, but he was here last Friday. I've recorded this interview. It's 25 minutes long, so let's play it now, and then I'll be back on the air with you at 5 minutes till 9. Reverend Rauschenbusch, thanks for joining us. How do you define Christian nationalism?
Well, Christian nationalism, first of all, let me say thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome.
Delighted to be speaking with you, and delighted to be able to talk about something that's really important that is happening in our country that we're still kind of hazy about understanding what it is and what it's not. Christian nationalism, first of all, I'll say what it's not. It's not a religious movement. And it's not a faithful exercise of religion in this country. And it's not a patriotic movement. It's a drive towards idolatry of nation, which is not the same as patriotism. And so what it's not is like the way to be a faithful Christian who's a patriot in America. It's actually Christian nationalism, to crystallize it very, very condensedly, is an ideological political movement and a quest for power. It's a using of rhetoric and a using of a mythology and a misreading and misunderstanding of history to say who really counts in this country, and then to develop a movement and a quest for power to enact policy that will make it clear whose rights are valued above others. So Christian nationalism is a small segment of the population of a diverse, pluralistic, wonderful country with all of its failings, but also all of its gifts. It's a small group of people who are trying to take control. They're using government to legislate their religious commitments, which exclude other religious commitments. And so it's a quest for power, and we have to understand it in those terms.
Well, yes, I think they want to promote the myth that we were founded as a Christian nation. Maybe you could disabuse us of that real quickly.
Well, I think that's one of the most important things that we have to really know our history. One of the great things, actually, that our founders did was they created the first country that was not founded as a theocracy. They had a non-establishment clause. First of all, the Constitution only mentions religion once. And do you know what that is? It first says there shall be no religious test for office. Oh. Very important. Amazing. Great. It means that anyone can hold public office. You don't have to have a religious test. Already disabusing us of this idea that we are a Christian nation. The next thing they did is say, not only that, we want to do another step. We want to say we are explicitly not establishing a religion in our country. They all came from states, by the way, that had establishments. Most states, when they were founding, had established religions, whether that was Anglican or congregational or whatever. So what they said was, you know what? No, let's not do that. Let's make space for everyone. Not only that, we have George Washington writing to the Baptists, writing to the Jewish congregation in Newport. This is a very important letter that he wrote in 1796. To the Jewish congregation in Newport, saying, we don't talk about toleration of other religious traditions in this country. No one is tolerated. Everyone is here and the same. And not only that, there's something called the Treaty of Tripoli, which people don't know about, but it was a trade treaty with Muslim countries. And this happened also towards the end of the 17th century. And it was signed, it was written by George Washington, signed by President Adams, ratified unanimously by the Senate. And it has this phrase in it: as the United States is in no way founded as a Christian nation, we have no reason for enmity against Muslim nations. These are documents. These are facts. Now, the fact that a lot of times say, well, but they were all Christian. First of all, no, they weren't. They were not Christian by the way you want to define it. And even if they were Christian, by and large, the fact that they decided not to use their power as Christians to force that everyone else would have second-class status in this country is even more reason that today we should celebrate that brilliance and celebrate the diversity and the richness of religious tradition that it's allowed America to have. This is a very important point. So the next time you hear someone say this is a Christian nation, know that they are factually incorrect, but also that they're saying that in order to have power today. They're trying to retroactively change history in order to give themselves power. And by the way, I'm a Baptist minister. When they say Christian, they don't mean me. They mean a Christian made in their own image that believes exactly what they do. Anti-LGBT, censoring books, restricting women's right to have choices about their body, deciding what we can learn and not learn, and who counts as far as religion in America. So I know you said a quick answer. I couldn't give you a quick answer.
No.
I think it's really important that all of your listeners understand we are not in a defensive posture about Christianity and the founding of this nation. We have the receipts. We know the facts.
Oh, then I wonder how they arrived at their position. They're about 20%, I think, of what Christians is, or is that a too large a percentage?
No, you're about right. And part of that is this propaganda. So what happened is that, in the 1950s, we had God added to our Pledge of Allegiance. It was not there to start. And so they did it in that moment because everyone's like, very, very nervous. And in times of nervousness, they lean back into what they think will help, kind of solidify, some sort of religious underpinning. And so they said, they added God into the Pledge of Allegiance, and we start seeing God we trust in places. But and then they actually tried to have a constitutional amendment to change our constitution to include Jesus and God. And they were failed. And they didn't fail because all the secular people rose up. They failed because the other religious people said, no, that's not what we need. We need to keep our establishment clause. We need to keep it so that everyone has equal rights under this country. Because that's what allows all of us to thrive. And so the fact that they tried to put in a constitutional amendment saying, let's put in God, put in Jesus, means that they know that from the beginning it wasn't there. And so we keep seeing this come up periodically, and we're in another moment. And I would say this is a really existential crisis for this country, because what also indicates Christian nationalism is a propensity towards violence. It has been proven by polling they are 7 times more likely to approve violence as a means of getting what they want than the average American. Wow. They say it may be things are getting so the question they respond to, things are getting so off track that it may be the responsibility of white Christians to use violence to keep the country from going off track. And so we saw that, of course, on January 6th. And if people want to get a crystallized understanding of what Christian nationalism is, Christian nationalism fueled January 6th. And if you all, you're about to have the opportunity to see a great film called God and Country with Rob Reiner and Dan Parklin, who made this great film. It's coming out February 16th. If you want to hear an interview with Rob Reiner and Dan Parklin, I did it on my podcast called The State of Belief. Sorry to shamelessly plug it, but it really got into you will appreciate what Christian nationalism is, where it comes from, and what it is planning to do, which is really the threat of violence. There's a chilling quote that has someone said in there, who's a conservative from that conservative evangelical background. He said, if democracy comes up against Christian nationalist aims, democracy will lose.
Whoa.
That's what we're talking about.
And you've said, I think in one other talk I read or heard, you said that in addition, this movement is grounded in fear. Explain that.
100%. So, this is where I actually as much as I'm very animated against its ideology, and I am very I want to feel you know, love and compassion for this idea of like, I don't understand what's happening around me. Like, the country is getting more diverse. The country is going to become, you know, the white Protestant majority that has been understood as kind of permanent for hundreds of years is now about to erase. The percentage of Christians is going to go under 50%. Right. The percentage of white people is going to go under 50%. People are scared, and there's like, and there's an economic pressure where we have widening economic differences, where and people are getting squeezed. Not to, you know, black and brown people for sure, who have always had to struggle, but also white Americans who are lower income are seeing like their, you know, their possibility of doing, you know, becoming you know, better than the generation before them. They're seeing that slip away, and they're looking for like, well, what, you know, why, where can I place my anger? Well, you can believe there's very little incentive for those who are like the multi billionaires that we have, for them to say, well, maybe you could place it in me. They're not going to do that. So there's like, there's another way that, and this is part of the fear that people have. And somehow that is a very hard thing to counteract. And the only way I think we can counteract it is by trying to explain to people that no one is trying to take away the rights of conservative Christians.
Right.
No one is trying to say you cannot, you can believe what you want to believe, and you can even do what you want to do. You just can't infringe on the rights and the civil rights and the dignity and the respect of other Americans. That's where it kind of hits the road. But otherwise, we want you to feel free. Just want, like, I want to feel free. And so I just think like speaking into that fear clearly is something that we just need to also keep in mind as we mobilize against Christian nationalism in this time.
And typically they support Donald Trump, of all people, who's not exactly what I would call a Christian. Why is that? Why are they attracted to him? Simple answers, strong man. What is it? What is it about Donald Trump?
Well, you know, I mean, it's interesting. And again, I encourage people to watch God and Country, because they laid that out in a way that even me, who has been, you know, thinking about this for a long time, was kind of like, ooh. You know, at first it was hesitance. You know, at first they were kind of like, ugh, this isn't a great candidate. He's like, we've been talking about that moral character matters for years. And this guy is clearly like, you know, one fellow says, like, we used to preach sermons about the seven deadly sins, and we would use Donald Trump as a case in point of all of them. But then they realized that that, you know, they even used some theology. They kind of decided, oh, he's King Cyrus, who wasn't part of, you know, who wasn't part of like you know, in the Old Testament. And it's a story like he's outside of the, you know, the tribe of Israel, but he's doing God's work as a surrogate. And he, you know, and now, though, he really is like, you know, it's a little bit of this, like, they want someone who's strong. They want someone who will fight back, who's like the fist for their movement. And, yeah. And he has been saying, like, I am your, you know, he used to say, I'm your only hope. Now he says, I'm your retribution.
Whoa.
Which is like vengeance. And there's a lot of anger out there. And so you're, you know, I think he taps in. He's really, you know, I think he's getting less smart, but he was very savvy on understanding the power. And so in the 2000s, run up to this 2016 election, he's like, you guys have so much power, you're not using it. I will help you use it. And so he felt like they felt seen, and they felt like he was going to represent their interests. And now he, I think they, you know, it is bizarre to me. And, you know, he's just decided that he's going to lean into January 6th. And he's going to say, this was a good thing. It was a necessary thing, because the election was stolen from me, in part because they built it up so much. The Christian nationalists built it up so much that he was God's candidate. And they still do this. And how can God's candidate lose? And that's the biggest threat of, you know, maybe not the big, it's all of a piece, but that is a huge threat. Once you say you're God's candidate and people believe it, instead of living in a democracy where we actually try to vote and we try to figure this out together and we have compromise and we keep muddling along, but no one says, like, I have the divine mandate to rule. And once you acclaimed that and other people have ascribed it to you, how can you lose? And so someone must have been cheating. And that's what happened in 2020. He was ordained to win, and they all knew he was going to win. And then when he lost, they were like, "Well, this is because the people are going against God's will." And you see how that it spiritualizes in a terrible way.
Wow.
Our politics, and so our politics do not become a system of democracy where it's the people, we the people, who rule. It becomes like the politics of good versus evil. And you hear that a lot in the rhetoric of Christian nationalism, good versus evil. And good is on the side in their mind of Donald Trump, and all of and evil are, well, it's you, Tom.
I'm
joking. But you know what I mean? So if it's a question of God's candidate versus evil, What don't you have the right to do? Of course you're going to use force, because, you know, historically, and this is a great point that Anathea Butler, who's a wonderful professor of religion at University of Pennsylvania, she's like, do you really think the history of Christianity is filled with peaceful people? Go back and look. Like, this is a violent, often a very violent movement, and we are seeing violence in the name of their faith. What is true, and I need to make sure that the listeners hear this, is that they are a minority of religious people in America. The majority, the vast majority, 70% of America wants equality for LGBTQ people now. It's not even close. Many more people, well over half, and in fact, post Dobbs, 60% of Americans want some protection of the right for people to be able to choose to have an abortion. So you know, it was censorship, very unpopular. So what is true is they do not represent the people, and they do not represent religion. And my organization, Interfaith Alliance, was founded in 1994 as a response to the oversized power of the Christian Coalition, Pat Robertson, Ralph Reed, Jerry Falwell, all these people who are saying, we represent the religion of America. Well, no, you don't. You represent a thin slice of it, you know, a powerful but thin slice of it. And there is a big other percentage of American religious people, plus a whole big chunk of people who are not religious at all, who have equal rights to their own beliefs and their own expression of those beliefs in the lives they live. And so that's the important thing, is that they will claim religion, they will claim God, but we can't let them have that narrative. And that's what we're talking about in Sarasota last week, is like, we can't let them have that narrative that they speak for God, they speak, they're the religious party. They aren't. There's a much broader coalition it will not let them have that. So there is a lot of hope right now, but it does require that we stand up for the broader majority and make sure that Christian nationalists can't get that one slice of American religion imposed on the rest of us using the levers of government.
Good point about what can we do? What can congregations or you and your alliance do to inoculate Americans or congregations against this rising tide of Christian nationalism?
Well, that's the real point, is like, look around. I mean, I gave a talk about Christian nationalism to a group in Naples, and they looked around and said, oh my God, well, they're the ones who just won the election to the school board. They're trying to put in things that are terrible for our Jewish students, for our atheist students, for all kinds of religious students. They're trying to do this. And then they realize, oh, we're not alone. We actually have a huge amount of power. And so they started showing up.
Yes.
And they started pushing back. And now the school board is like, wait, where did these people come from? And it's because the Interfaith Alliance of Southwest Florida started showing up. And, you know, the Christian nationalists are wanting to stop any pride event in Naples for the first time in years. And then now people are like, wait a second.
Right.
Who are you speaking for? Who are you trying to do this for? So the great news is that congregations, You know, whether, if you are a member of a congregation, make sure your congregation is a place where diverse perspectives are welcome, that people can learn together, where truth, and by the way, truth is going to be the rarest of commodities. The most precious thing you can have will be truth in this next election, because AI-generated fakes, there's going to be so much fake news, there's going to be so much disinformation that you need to, congregations can be a place where you can really hear real information, and you can help, like, oh, well, could you show up with me at the school board? It can be a place where you get out information. And Christian nationalism, I mean, we had a congregation connected with an Interfaith Alliance out in Central California. Proud Boys came and smashed all their windows after they had an LGBT fundraiser.
Wow.
The rest of the interfaith community immediately said, what do you need? We're going to show up. And you had Muslim, Jewish, Indigenous, all showing up in that congregation saying, we're not going to let them intimidate you. They're not going to let them use the terrorism to intimidate us. So use the power that is within congregations. And the biggest thing is don't delegitimize your own religious voice. You have a legitimate religious voice. And if you're an atheist and if you're a humanist, that is a legitimate religious voice in America. You have every bit of right as anyone else. And so don't let anyone say you can't speak. You can speak and you can represent. Everyone can represent and look out for a broad coalition of people of different faith traditions coming together to say, we're speaking up together, because no one, we don't want anyone to just be tolerated, as George Washington said, we should never have in this country. And so we have to stand up, speak out, and show up. Show up for one another when you see anti-Semitism. Show up when you see anti-Muslim hate. Show up when you see a Hindu temple defaced. Show up for one another and show up to protect our ballot boxes. Show up to protect polls. Make sure that you, everywhere that democracy, you can imagine them. Because right now, 2020, I really feel, was like a test. Everywhere that there's weakness, they are going to be pressuring it this next time. And so we need to all show up and be aware, take care of one another, be safe, but also make sure that they don't, that there is no reason that Christian nationalism should be able to claim the religious voice, because they don't represent religion in America.
Wow, I love it. And I agree with everything you've said. And it's amazing that we're just now waking up to this threat and then what we can do about it. I appreciate everything you've said, and you'll be speaking. It's too late for the people listening to this, but you'll be speaking to Sarasota this weekend and elsewhere, I'm sure, all across the nation.
The wonderful thing is, I really encourage people to get involved. Even though Naples, I know, isn't like Sarasota, but the Interfaith Alliance of Southwest Florida, you'd be welcome to learn from them. We're also in relationship with Mosaic, which in Miami, which is a wonderful interfaith organization there, and we're talking to people in Tampa. I mean, Interfaith Alliance is really here to be helpful. We have all sorts of resources on our website. So and please sign up for our email list so that you can get alerts on how to show up, and we connect you very easily to elective officials and everything like that. So if you go to interfaithalliance.org, you can sign up and get alerts. And then also, if you go to State of Belief, I'm interviewing some wonderful people who are really on the forefront of talking about Christian nationalism, anti-Semitism, and other forms of threats against our country, and offering hope in this time when we really need some hope. And so I encourage you guys, join us.
The State of Belief is your podcast?
Yeah.
And how do I find that?
If you just go to stateofbelief.org, you can find it. Is it .com? Thank you, Tom. If you go to stateofbelief.com, you can find it. I have, interviews with Tim Alberta, with people like Rain Wilson, who's from The Office, but a wonderful Baha'i talker, Muslim, Jewish, humanist. I mean, we really try to give a broad perspective of religion in America. And so please join us and sign up.
Would you mind if we played excerpts from it in the future on our show?
I would love it.
Okay.
The more people who hear it, that's the whole point. So please, please mine it. It's really a wonderful resource, and I would love for you to hear it, and also for you to use it in any way that would be beneficial to your listeners.
Okay, we will do it. We've been talking to Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch, the president and CEO of Interfaith Alliance. And thank you for joining us. Thank you for the work you do. I'm an atheist, but I agree with everything you said. We've got to wake up and take our country back in the sense of freedom of expression and religion and citizen rights. So wonderful work you're doing. Thank you so much. We'll end the interview now, but
I really appreciate being with you, Tom, and I really appreciate your collegiality and how important it is for all of us to work together.
All right. Well, thank you. See you later. Okay. That was the Reverend Paul Rauschenbusch. And I'm going to check out his podcast, stateofbelief.com. That's the web address. He's president and CEO of the Interfaith Alliance. What a great proponent or exponent of his view, which I happen to agree with. And we really appreciate him being on the show. That's about it today for the Peace and Justice Report. Bob Connors will be back next week. And by the way, next week we'll interview an author with a brand new book, Rachel Bitcoffer. And her new book is called Hit 'em Where It Hurts: How to Save Democracy by Beating Republicans at Their Own Game. It just came out this week. They sent me a copy. I'm going to start reading it right after this show. By the way, our area has some great speakers live to listen to, Sarasota Institute of Lifetime Learning, but yesterday I heard historian Heather Cox Richardson at the Longbow Key Democratic Club. She was there and she gave a great talk. Her new book, or not so new, maybe a few months old, her book is called Democracy Awakening. It's Heather Cox Richardson, and she's a historian. But she mixes history with current events to give us a perspective, and she writes very clearly. You can read her daily comments at no charge at heathercoxrichardson.substack.com. I want to put in a plug. We've got a couple more minutes. I want to put in a plug for the front page of WSLR. Ever since we hired Johannes Werner as the news director, the front page has 5, 6, 7, or 10 stories, local stories about local ecology, politics, and so forth. All of them you can read or listen to. What a great front page we've got now with all our local stories. And don't forget that the events at Fogartyville, we have much more than we used to almost every day. So check out Fogartyville events. Excuse me. Congratulations to our station, to Johannes, and to everybody who's doing such a great job at the station. We'll be having a fundraiser in the spring. There'll be a big event later in the spring we'll tell you about. So I am continue to be, very proud of this station and Fogartyville and WSLR and what it's done in this community. And we hope you'll volunteer and take the time to tell other people about it. Listen whenever you can, and take part. We welcome volunteers. In about 10 seconds, you're going to hear Democracy Now!, one of the best international news, national news programs that I...